So I just violated the policy we set up for every other speaker, which was don't give us your slides right before you present. And I just tried to make a bunch of changes based on everybody else presenting this morning, and it crashed Erica's laptop. So we're going to try to see if this is going to work. And it's a pleasure for me to be here today. As a member of the committee that put this program together, and then also as a committee that's actually implementing, holding this event, it's great for me to be here, especially I think it was 20 years ago that I got to go to my first Range Beef Cow Symposium. So it's humbling to be on this side of the presentation side and to share with you some of the data we've collected at CSU. I will say, though, I was not the first choice, and the committee will admit it. We had two or three people before me, and conveniently they had other things to do today. So I am going to share with you what I've done in animal welfare and a little bit of the work we've done at CSU, and maybe building off of some things that others have talked about earlier. And there may be a little bit of overlap, but hopefully not very much. So trying to go through here. I think we have to switch the remote control. Yep. It's really running smoothly until I get up here. So the first slide I'm going to show you is my goal for today. And my goal for today is not to defend any activist group or people who are questioning what we as beef cattle producers are doing. At the same time, I'm not here to question industry practices. I'm simply here as a member of a land-grant university to share with you information that we are learning about animal welfare so that we can get a better handle on this as a beef cattle industry. So this has been said many times earlier, just pointing out the fact that society has identified concerns with animal welfare, particularly in cattle. And I've pulled off some data from Kansas State University. Glenn Tonzer and a graduate student did a large survey simultaneously of both producers and consumers on a whole number of things related to animal welfare. And I pulled a few just key slides out of their slide set to share with you. One of the ones I think many of us would not be surprised by is when they asked the U.S. public, are you concerned about animal welfare and beef cattle? Two-thirds of them said yes. And I think that probably makes sense. We could relate to that. Then I've got two slides here, and they're a little bit complicated to look at first, but let's kind of break them down. The first one was they said this statement to both producers and the public. They said, low beef prices are more important than the well-being of cattle. Do you agree or disagree with that? And the purple bars are producers, and the blue bars is the U.S. public. And you can kind of go across there and see where some of this discrepancy is. But the thing that kind of pointed out to me was only 57% of the public disagreed with this statement. So more than half of the people disagreed that low beef prices are more important than well-being. I was surprised by that number. Or said it another way, 43% of them did not disagree, meaning they didn't necessarily agree with this statement, but they do recognize the balance between production and well-being that sometimes the industry is facing. Similar to this is another question that builds off of this, and I'll move on to some other material. But this question is, I believe that cattle producers face a trade-off between profitability and animal welfare. Only 20% of public respondents disagreed with this. And when you looked at producers, almost 40% or more than a third did not disagree, meaning they did not disagree with the point that I believe cattle producers face a trade-off. They didn't necessarily agree with it, but they did not disagree. So let's talk a little bit about animal welfare in our industry. How are we addressing this as an industry? We've heard some great talks this morning, particularly from Tyson and what they have developed. But let's back up for a second and look at what the industry's view of this has been. And one thing I've pulled out is a fact sheet written for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association with checkoff dollars, intended to be an inward look at the beef cattle industry of welfare concerns. And if you want to pull this off of the internet, you can. Tucker was the graduate student, I believe, that wrote this. A really great list of co-authors, including Temple Grandin and others who are leaders in this area. So let me go through these eight things that the beef cattle industry, through NCBA, said these are probably concerns we have with welfare. The first one is related to nutrition and growth, and this is industry-wide, cows, calves, feedlot cattle, all the way across the board. A few things that came up there was abrupt weaning, disease due to high-concentrate diets. That's basically feeding corn to cattle and the acidosis that sometimes will result, and liver abscesses, which are caused by an acidic environment in the rumen. Borderline body condition score. For instance, many of us try to push the grazing season later to try to overcome lower or higher priced feedstuffs. And so by doing that, sometimes we have a tight balance on body condition score of cows. That was something brought up. And then the other one was production technologies. And those are sort of three classifications. One of them would be the use of antibiotics. The other one, hormonal implants. And the third one, beta agonists. And notice, these are brought up as welfare concerns related to nutrition and growth. The second area was health and just simply having lameness in cattle, which does occur. And they brought up respiratory issues. For instance, bovine respiratory disease. The fact that cattle have a higher prevalence of BRD than we would probably like. Some could view that as a welfare concern. Again, this is an inward look of our industry, kind of a critique. Number three, the fact that there are painful procedures done on beef cattle, castration, dehorning, and branding being those identified, at least done with no pain mitigation. And I'm going to follow up on this a little bit later in my presentation. Number four, winter weather, just the fact that we have cattle, they're outside, it can get muddy and wet. Heat load in summertime and the potential of using shade or water to alleviate heat stress. We've probably heard this more in feedlot cattle than we probably in any other class of cattle. Number six, social interaction. It was brought up, commingling of cattle. So on the one hand, animals that are by themselves may be suffering from some deficit with interaction. At the same time, when animals are exposed to cattle from a different place, that are maybe they're naive from an immune standpoint, commingling of cattle through an auction market, that may be a welfare concern, whether it's their health and stress or just the fact that 2 to 4% of cattle have this Buller steer syndrome, where sometimes those cattle can't be removed from a pen. High stocking density and aggression would be more of a feed yard standpoint, where social interaction is not maybe normal based on the concentration of cattle in a pen. Transportation, mostly cattle on semis, the amount of space they're given, feed and water, weather conditions, how far they've been hauled, rest intervals, unloading, a variety of things related to that. And then the last one, and this is very interesting, the last point which was brought up as an animal welfare possible concern was slaughter, which you would think about it. If you're talking about actually slaughtering an animal, rendering it unconscious, bleeding it out, that is our probably least concerning animal welfare problem. And I think if you went 30 years ago, it probably would be number one. But thanks to Temple Grandin and a number of things the packing industry has done, it has actually become pretty much almost a non-issue. We've mastered the method of killing animals and dealing with any pain or sensibility at that time. So that was basically what NCBA on your behalf evaluated for animal welfare concerns. Let's go to the other side, which is the Humane Society of the United States. And the name was brought up earlier of this organization. CSU is actually a land-grant university that hosted the executive director of HSUS on campus for a dialogue in this area. But a number of years ago, the Humane Society of the United States, about 5 years ago, came out with a document that said, these are our concerns about the welfare of calves in the beef industry. Ronnie Green actually also had a citation of this, similar to this document. Let me just read a couple of quotes that came from a group that has shown to be an activist group in the industry. While many other commercially produced animals used in agriculture, such as pigs and chickens, are raised in indoor confinement facilities, young calves in the beef industry are largely permitted to roam outdoors, which in comparison is a substantial welfare improvement. And if you just read that at face value, that was somewhat of a pat on the back by HSUS of the beef industry. We have designed an industry that generally has much less issues probably with animal welfare. However, they didn't necessarily leave it at that. They also went on to say, painful and stressful events, especially when experienced concurrently, meaning at the same time, are deeply concerning. Abrupt weaning of young animals, mutilations without pain relief, and branding are serious issues that must be addressed, was also in the same document. And as you'd imagine, the activist industries are often much better at defining terms before we can get to it. And by defining something as a mutilation, that's anything from putting an ear tag in to castrating to branding. When you use the word mutilation for that, no consumer is probably going to be okay with that scenario. So they've identified five things that are bothering HSUS, if you assume that they speak on behalf of activist groups. And those are abrupt weaning versus a low-stress or natural weaning, calf transportation, both distance and space allowed, and then these three, what they're calling painful procedures, castration, horn bud or horn removal versus using polled cattle, and then branding. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about those in a few seconds. So the big concerns are these practices used? Are they done? Yes or no? And then how are they done? For instance, castration. We know there's a number of ways we can castrate cattle. Knife cut, banding, burdizzo, branding. We can do it a number of ways. Hot iron freeze, dehorning, pace tipping or scooping. A lot of different methods are available. So it's not clear which are or which aren't painful or to what degree. And then also, is pain mitigation, meaning is anything done to block pain in these animals, yes or no? And there's kind of two ways of doing that. At the time the procedure's done, we would look at anesthesia, which if anybody's had a surgery or anything, you know, your skin gets numbed. Anesthesia has been used so that you don't feel that sharp pain. And then also analgesia, some sort of thing over time where it's dealing with the pain that resulted from that procedure. And then also age of animal has come up a number of times since there's indication that animals respond differently to inflammation as their age varies. So before we get into some of the science behind these areas, let's just look a little bit about how we're dealing with pain relief in cattle. And this is probably one of our biggest Achilles heels, honestly. This is my personal opinion. Currently, there are no drugs approved by FDA for pain relief in beef cattle. I just want to clarify that and restate it. Currently, there are no drugs approved by FDA for pain relief in beef cattle. So even if we acknowledge that one of our procedures might be painful, by law, we do not have a way of mitigating that pain, which is very surprising in an industry that has begun to basically acknowledge the challenges with animal welfare. There are some products that are used, though, and I think a number of us have done it, and we've actually done it legally, and I'll talk about why. One of them is flunixin megalamine or banamine. It's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, has to be given intravenously, which honestly is challenging for some producers. But it's only labeled to deal with fever associated with bovine respiratory disease, endotoxemia, and acute mastitis. It is not used for pain. It's not labeled for use for pain mitigation. We give it to cattle to deal with pain, and I'll talk about why. So this is something called extra label drug use. It's going beyond the label of the product. And it's not legal, and I put that in quotes by anyone, veterinarians included. However, there's an exception called AMDUCA. Who's heard of AMDUCA in here, out of curiosity? Something we talk about in beef quality assurance. It's a huge thing in our industry if you actually think about it. It's called the Animal Medicinal Drug Use Clarification Act. Let me talk about that. And I know I have a lot of jargon up here, but I'm going to try to get to the point of this. This drug act was passed a little about 20 years ago, and it was intended to allow veterinarians to go beyond the label for addressing suffering if these conditions are met. So it has to be done under a veterinarian's supervision. Only drugs that are approved by FDA in some other species. You can't use something from Europe that has never been in the United States. It's only permitted when the health of the animal is threatened. It cannot be used for production. You cannot do this to increase gain, feed efficiency, anything. It only can be used to address health of an animal, including pain. You cannot give it in the feed, and you cannot do it if it results in a violative drug residue. And there's some data for some of the drugs we're using, but not all of them have complete data on drug approval, on violative residues. And that's something, if you get FDA approval, you have to have the violative residue addressed. So let's talk about that for a second. There's a drug called meloxicam. Has anybody heard of meloxicam? And some of you may be cat owners. I won't make you put your hand up for that. It's approved in cats, and it's a tiny little pill. It's in that little bolus there. It's approved for food animal use in the EU and Canada, not the United States. So what we actually can do is through Amduca, we can load 40 pills into a little bolus and give it to a steer if we just castrated him. And it has a 27.5-hour half-life, meaning it sticks around for a day. So if you give it on a daily basis, the animal should have this circulating. Flunixin megalamine's half-life is 1/4 that. It's somewhere around 6 hours. So if you give flunixin megalamine banamine, it's good for 6 hours, and then the animal could be in pain the rest of that time. The reason I brought this up is we've started doing research with meloxicam through Amduca to evaluate if it maybe could be a pain mitigation strategy for these challenging methods that we're putting cattle through. So I pulled one other slide here from Case State, and this is some survey data. I know that's hard to read up there, but let me focus on the 3 points that have red stars next to them. K-State asked producers, they said, do you castrate male calves either within the first 3 months of age or with pain control? And it's about 55% do that. So 45% castrate them older or without pain control. And they also asked, do you dehorn or disbud calves before the horn tissue adheres to the skull or with pain control? And that's 33%, so 1/3. And then just interestingly, the last one there is, do you participate in a third-party verification that appropriate animal care and facilities are provided on the farm? It's around 9%. Those are the people doing some of these programs that Laura identified before this. So if you think about it, generally most of us are castrating and dehorning and branding cattle with no pain mitigation. There's no rule out there that says we have to, but recognize consumers are concerned, and truly we don't have a labeled drug to address this point. So let me very quickly go through the fact that we have laws in this country for humane handling of animals, humane slaughter, but they primarily revolve around slaughter since about 1958. And these are enforced at packing plants by veterinarians and inspectors. And there are some rules that apply to sale barns and other things like that. But the reality of it is we don't really have regulation on welfare back at the ranch level. A lot of it is because Temple Grandin partnered with packing plants and the American Meat Institute and NCBA and started auditing packing plants on behalf of McDonald's and others people and said, these are things that need to change. So she actually has kind of postponed this regulation. But you can see that currently fast food retailers have basically pushed this. There's still no regulation necessarily to deal with castration, dehorning, and branding. However, if you're a resident of the state of Colorado, you've seen this in the news several times with tail docking and either other approaches to change some of the procedures that we use on farms and ranches. There's a group associated with the Colorado Department of Agriculture who is addressing this, but it's still very much up in the air, and it seems to come up as a ballot initiative several times. I'm not going to spend much time on Whole Foods. Laura did a great job of outlining the Global Animal Partnership. Let me just skip to a couple of quick things. I do want to point out that Whole Foods, this is a close-up, and it's probably still hard to see, but it's between step 2 and step 4 or 5 cattle. And if you go to Whole Foods and ask at their meat case, they'll give you one of these documents. And you can see as you move from left to right, for instance, maximum castration age at 3 months is in the left-hand column. If you go to the far right column to level 5, you cannot castrate cattle if you sell them to Whole Foods and sell them as level 5. Also, minimum weaning age on all the way on the left is 6 months. If you go all the way on the right, it's either 8 months or what's called natural weaning, which is basically not weaning. The reason I bring this up is our concern as a land-grant university is, are these science-based guidelines or standards? In our view, some of them may be, most of them are not. And so our direction has been to provide scientific data to organizations that want to come up with standards so that if you want a label on your product and have somebody pay a premium for it, that's tremendous. But the goal is to use guidelines or standards that are based in science. That's at least our approach on this. So the challenges with this is we've historically measured welfare based on things like animal performance, gain, efficiency. Consumers don't buy that that's an appropriate way of identifying an animal as being ideal in their welfare scenario. If just because they're gaining at a maximal level does not mean they're in the best welfare. So we have basically tried to address things like pain or stress. And it's hard to even indicate what's different about those two things. But the challenge is these things are confounded based on animal handling. As soon as you run an animal in the chute, it's going to exhibit stressful or painful activity, even though it may not truly be that painful of an event compared to maybe some procedure we do to them. So what we've started to do is come up with objective and subjective manners of evaluating pain or stress. And one of the first one is escape behavior, and we focus on the escape of the cattle, not of the people handling the cattle. So how do we determine well-being? Let me go through a few things here. Some of the things we've started to do, one of them is called exit velocity. It's not a great picture, but this is our chute at CSU at our RDEC facility, and you can see there's some tripods off to the left and the right. These are the same timers you'd use at a barrel racing competition or team roping, anything like that. We time how fast cattle run out of the chute to determine if they experience a bad experience and if they continually display that behavior after they leave the chute. We also try to do video-based evaluations. This one's on head movement. Again, it's a little tricky to see this. Over on the left side on the top, animal has its head all the way down. On the left side on the bottom, animal has its head all the way up. And so the picture on the right is we measure using a video the distance that they move their head from the lowest point to the highest point. And if anybody's castrated many animals, when you castrate them, typically they have a big lunge forward where their head goes up in the squeeze chute. And we basically measure that, whatever we're doing. And this has been not only the distance, but also the speed in which they do that. Another thing is something called chute score. When an animal comes into a chute, you often will score them. This is a continuous line where you put an X across there. On the left, if they're calm. On the right, if they're aggressive or anywhere in between, you measure it with a ruler, and that's their number in terms of how excitable those animals are in the chute. So we've tried to use these several things in addition to what we call in-pen behaviors, where we're looking at if animals are laying down after a procedure, if their intake changes, if they're bawling, if their flight zone changes, a number of things like that. So very briefly, let me just show you one research study, which was not done at CSU. It's one of the foundation research studies in this area, just to show you that you can do peer-reviewed research in this area to evaluate something, for instance, such as branding. Karen Schwarzkopf-Genswein is a, I'd say, world expert in this area. She's based up in Canada. She's helped us down here with a number of animal welfare activities. And she did a study. It wasn't very many steers. And they basically use hot iron branding, freeze branding, or what they call sham or no branding. They basically acted like they were branding the animal but did not ever actually brand them. And they used a video to look at things like tail flicks, kicks, falling, or vocalization. And then also they measured something called strain gauge. So the hydraulics, you can actually put measurements on those to see if the cattle are pushing against it, and including force against the head gate. So this is off of her paper. These are, again, hard to see. But you can see on the left-hand side, the animal has its head at the top and the upper left and then at the bottom. And then over on the right-hand side on the bottom is the low spot. And their computer actually measures the speed which with their nose goes across the screen as an indication of to see if there are differences between different treatments. So I boiled her results into four bullet points, and I'm glad Karen's not here because she'd probably kill me for doing that. But I just want to hit the high points. Number one, if you just look at maximum and average head movement, the maximum number of times they move their head or the average number of times, hot iron cattle moved them more than freeze cattle, which moved them more than sham, meaning they were statistically different between the three groups. Number two, maximum exertion force on the head gate load. Hot was higher than freeze. Freeze equaled sham. So you could identify in a sentence, hot iron branding caused cattle to have more exertion force against the head gate, more so than freeze or sham branding, and there was no difference between freeze and sham branding. Head gate strain and squeeze load, no differences across any of the treatments. And then the last one, the number of tail flicks, kicks, falling, and vocalization. Hot iron had the greatest number of tail flicks, kicks, falling, and vocalization. Sham had the least. So the reason I point this out is I want to just leave you with some conclusions that I've drawn as someone that's relatively new to this research area, but recognizes the industry has to provide a solution. That number one, society is becoming increasingly concerned. I think you've heard that loud and clear this morning. But options are available for consumers to purchase welfare verified beef, whether it's at the retail level or something that's being verified through a packer. The standards, the guidelines, those things the Global Animal Partnership is auditing you on are not yet science-based, and the data are hard to generate because where we used to get funding for this research, the federal government no longer funds this research. We have to get it from private industry or somehow state-level funding. The beef industry should probably take the lead on this. That's my opinion. Data suggests several procedures are painful. I thought about going through a whole review of all the literature, but I didn't want to bore you. But I'll say there's evidence there, and it's increasing. And last, no drugs are available for pain mitigation. No drug company has gone through the expensive and timely process to get an approval on their label that this product can be used for pain mitigation. And I don't necessarily blame them because there hasn't been a great demand by the industry. But at the same time, how do we address a consumer who's concerned about this when we say, well, we do these things that might be painful and we try to do them in the least painful manner, but we really don't have anything legally to use to address the pain? So with that, I hope I stimulated some thoughts. I look forward to a bullpen session tonight. Unfortunately, Ronnie Green obviously wasn't here. Michelle Payne-Noper is not able to stay with us tonight. And then Cameron Brewitt, who's going to be after lunch on sustainability, he's unable to be here. But Dr. Jim Robb, myself, and Laura Wright will be at the bullpen sessions. We're going to combine all of these morning sessions into one. And we're going to have a great discussion tonight over in the McKee building. So thanks very much for having me, and look forward to visiting with you in the next 2 days.